Join left, right, and center host Bob Scheer for his new podcast, Scheer Intelligence. The twice-monthly podcast features thinkers and trendsetters in conversation with one of political journalism's leading voices. Through the show's unique and sometimes surprising perspectives, you'll get up to speed on the current issues shaping the Beltway and the world. Find Scheer Intelligence on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
Terrorists struck in Brussels this week, killing at least 31. How should the West respond, and which presidential candidates are taking the right approaches? Meanwhile, Barack Obama made the first presidential visit to Cuba since Calvin Coolidge. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com and host of the KCRW podcast Scheer Intelligence. On the right is Republican strategist Leslie Sanchez. And our special guest is Steve Clemens. He's Washington editor-at-large for The Atlantic. Welcome to you all. So very sad news this week in Brussels, where suicide bombers perpetrated two attacks on Tuesday at the airport and in the subway, killing at least 31 people, including two Americans. Steve, I want to start with you since you were in Brussels on Tuesday and arrived at the airport just minutes after the attacks happened. First of all, we're glad you're safe. Tell us about what you saw on Tuesday.
Well, I'm safe. Many people that morning are not and were victims injured and people killed. And so it's important to keep that in our minds. But I had been planning to return to Washington and go there and had arrived that morning beneath the airport. The train station comes in at the bottom and was coming up when those bomb blasts went off. And it was a pretty horrific scene. It was haze and, you know, like you can imagine anything where something's blown up, there's a sort of a lot of smoke, of course, but more importantly than that, the infrastructure of that great hall was shaken, so there was dust everywhere. And, of course, people at the other end of the hall, it's one of the largest halls I've been in, were traumatized running. Others that were just coming up had no idea. But really, we got a sense almost immediately that this was an attack. And what runs through your mind is, will a bomb go off on our end of the hall? Are there people with guns like we saw unfold in Bataclan in Paris in November? Those kinds of things. So getting out becomes an overwhelming need. And I thought, frankly, I want to give the forces there at the airport a lot of credit. They had trained recently for this kind of thing, interestingly, and they managed it really well. We were out very rapidly.
As we've been sort of looking at the aftermath this week and trying to figure out what happened, there have been a few things that people have been sort of scratching their heads at regarding the investigation and the response in Belgium to the last round of attacks in Paris. There's this issue that one of the bombers from this week's attacks was deported from Turkey to the Netherlands this last summer, and the Turks gave a warning to the Belgians that they don't seem to have followed up on. There was this revelation that Saleh Abdesalam, one of the planners of the Paris attack, he'd been in custody for days when this happened, but the Belgian authorities had spent only 1 hour questioning him. And then there was this news that a local Belgian police department had information about Abdesalam's location back in September, but failed to share it with national authorities. Is it fair, looking at this, Steve, to say that a really big part of what we're looking at is basically policing failures on the part of the Belgians involved in both the Paris attacks, which had a lot of participants with ties to Belgium, and the attacks that happened this week?
Yes. I mean, to be quite blunt, yes. Not only that, but the United States had given Belgium information and raised red flags about the brothers that were involved in this particular suicide bombing attack. So yes, there should be in the forensics of this a real indictment of that. I think from my own experience of, you know, covering national security issues, I believe the Belgians and French and Germans have upped their game in the intelligence arena, but clearly not anywhere near enough. I mean, when you've got all of these dots popping up, I have to tell you, I arrived in Brussels on Friday at a forum where we had the president of the European Commission, Senator Sessions, and Senator Jean Shaheen were there, Mike Froman, the U.S. Trade Representative, a lot of officials, NATO officials, intelligence. We probably had two or three guards at that place. And that was when the Saleh Abdesalam police action was taking place at exactly the same time, 3 kilometers away from us. And the next day, there was a slight beef up in the security around this very, you know, high-end forum. And then by Sunday and Monday, it had really dissipated and gone down. Someone told me that one of the ways in which Europe responds to a lot of these issues, and particularly in Belgium, is they are very reactive. You see a lot of security pipe up at once, and then it dissipates to nothing. And they said this is a very unreasonable way to think you're going to get security.
Bob, what sort of reaction do you think this attack calls for from the international community? Because one of the big worries that people are floating is that as ISIS's position weakens in Iraq and Syria, you're going to see a lot of the Europeans who've traveled there to fight returning to Europe and trying to perpetrate attacks like these.
Well, I think the first point to make is you don't go stirring up the whole world. I mean, we said that Syria was an awful place that required change, and these folks— were people who, by the way, product of European civilization. They're citizens. They're educated in Europe. You can't blame it on Muslim culture in some far-off land. And what changed was that we decided that forces coming out of Saudi Arabia and that the Saudis liked and sort of jihadists could be controlled and could be useful. That's what happened in fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan, and it happened with destabilizing Iraq and now Syria, basically run by secular dictatorships, not to minimize their how awful they were, but they certainly were not given to this jihadist view. And then to fight these people, and whether it's in Libya, Syria, Iraq, you recruit people and excite people in the West who are unhappy, discontented in their society. And that's what happened here. These people went to Syria in 2013-14, get trained, and then they come back. The other thing that I think we have to study here is it goes exactly against the narrative that supports the surveillance state. These people were not using encrypted high-tech information. They, in fact, were known to the authorities. What you're talking about is old-fashioned police work. Check on the suspects. You say went deported to the Netherlands. He asked to go back to the Netherlands. He felt comfortable there. We didn't listen to Turkey. It's not a question of not having enough of a haystack of information to go searching in for these needles. The fact is there's too much. And you don't do the obvious old-fashioned police work. And again, this goes back to even 9/11. One of the 19th hijacker was living in San Diego at the house of an FBI informant, and nobody ever checked that. The Boston Marathon bombers were well known because of their preoccupation with the Russians in Chechnya. You go every one of these incidents so far, the perps were well known. They could, it was a question of somebody go knock on a door or ask their neighbors what they're up to or check on them. You didn't have to go after Apple and hold Tim Cook responsible for disarray in the world. It's just not being serious about things that back in 1920 you could have been serious about doing.
So is there any U.S. role here then in your view? I mean, 'cause Hillary Clinton said this week that she actually thought that one upshot of this is that we do need to up our game in terms of interception of communications. Bernie Sanders said that he would provide necessary support to the Europeans without saying specifically what that meant. Is this, in your view, purely basically a Belgian and French policing issue going forward?
This is as significant as Trump saying he wants to build a bigger wall on the border with Mexico, where no one ever comes through who does this kind of thing. It's a distraction. It's scapegoating. It's garbage. The fact of the matter is, you said yourself, if they had just listened to the Turkish government, if they just followed up, if they just actually talked to someone they had in custody, if they'd done the most obvious, old-fashioned, even small-town police work, this wouldn't have happened. That was true in Boston, Paris, Belgium. It was true in California. And so what they do then is they say, no, there's got to be a high-tech solution. We have to destroy people's privacy. We have to get more information. We have to check everybody in the world. And you don't look at the most obvious people who have arrest records, who have traveled to Syria. You want to tell me that you had to check my emails in order to find out if these people left Brussels, went to Syria, came back, and what they've been doing? That's just old-fashioned police work. And so the whole tech thing and invading our privacy is really a cop-out to defend the incompetency of police agencies.
Leslie, what do you make of the reaction we've seen?
I disagree.
Okay, go ahead.
No, you know, with my deepest respect for my colleague sitting right here, I think it's the convergence. The reality is the solution is going to be the convergence of all of it. Some of this kind of law enforcement, police work you're talking about, it's the pains we have experienced even in this country, the failure of intelligence to make the connection. It was talking about shared intelligence and where there was a failure and with respect to who knew what when and actionable intelligence. And these were lessons that certainly the United States had to learn after the tragic events of 9/11. You're seeing a lot of the same types of failures in taking actionable intelligence and doing something about it. But now in the age we live in, I think that's when I talk about the convergence of using the best resources that are available, the technology that's available, with an understanding of protecting privacy when it is appropriate, of course. I think reasonable people will agree on that. But we cannot sit flat-footed on this. I think, if anything, everyone is going to take a beat and realize we have to put the best resources, the best intelligence, and find ways to work together using the best tools. And even things like working with moderate Muslims in some of these areas, it isn't this, unfortunately, these blanket approaches we're hearing through the political campaigns, which I think are short-sighted, ill-conceived, and to some point can be dangerous.
When you say that, are you referring to Ted Cruz talking about the need to patrol and secure Muslim neighborhoods?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think that that's really grounded in a very deep thought of how the long-term effect it can have. It will continue to force and encourage a breeding ground of jihadists who feel disenfranchised, who feel that this is more just it's identity politics used from a political standpoint, but it has such deep ramifications in a global environment. And if anything, I encourage my colleagues, we have to be much more careful and reasonable. And I think you've heard many Republicans step forward with a much more reasonable, calm, measured approach that talks about collaboration, shared intelligence, working forward, being going on the offense, and not this kind of knee-jerk response, you know, banning certain groups and such, that may be a great soundbite. And it may be what people want to hear when in an emotional time, but this is a long generational battle that really needs to be addressed critically.
Steve, what do you make of this? Because it seems to me like there's a conflation of what's happening in Europe and what's happening here. And in Europe, it seems to me like you do have a very real problem with isolated Muslim neighborhoods where radicalization takes place and where law enforcement does not have good insight into the neighborhood, does not have good links with the community, and allows plots like the one we saw in Brussels to be hatched. We have no such problem in the United States, right?
Well, there are uncomfortable parallels in the sense that what we do have in the United States are communities that continue to feel alienated, distant, segmented, and siloed away. When we've seen in Baltimore and Ferguson and other parts of the country, we still have an institutionalized bigotry and racism in the country that's requiring really, I think, important steps. And, you know, I can see both sides. The security side is something a lot of folks focus on, but there are people saying we need new pathways for people inside our own society, often with the Black community or Hispanic community or others, and we need to embrace each other and sort of change the dynamics that exist. That needs to happen in Paris suburbs. That needs to happen in the Molenbeek area, on the edge of central Brussels. Those kinds of bridge-building things aren't being discussed. It was my biggest disappointment in Hillary Clinton's speech, where she talked about, getting Europeans to share manifests of airlines like they do with the U.S. and, you know, doing these things that sound very policing-oriented, activist-oriented, which I support. I walked through that airport, and you wondered where are the dogs that smell, bombs, where the kind of presence. So I have that sense, but what's missing is a discussion of how you actually change the dynamic. If you're going to make common cause with the moderate Muslims, the first generation moderate Muslims felt very grateful to live in Paris and Brussels and Germany. But the second generation is growing up and sort of just feels screwed by their circumstances, very little job prospects, often housed in places that are very far away than others who have opportunity. That's not to say that terrorism automatically comes from those places, but it makes it an environment that is not that's toxic things come from that. And so you need to do both. You need to have something where we are smarter about our security issues and intelligence and doing those things. But if you don't begin to solve the areas, you got to understand what terrorism is. Terrorism is trying to pretend in its murderous way to look legitimate in the eyes of a certain group of people out there that have grievances and who have problems. And you've got, and our strategy is mostly to kill terrorists, not to steal their audience. We have to steal their audience.
Can I just respond to this? Because the three of you seem to basically agree that our foreign policy, our presence in the world has nothing to do with this turmoil that's been created. But your responses have all ignored that. I mean, here's Hillary Clinton, who did her best to destabilize the whole region. Her best, as not only as Secretary of State, but before. She defended every intrusion, every intervention, said we know what's best for these people. These European governments, I mean, France felt that they could just bomb Syria. They could destabilize a government. Libya, Gaddafi, who was a defanged dictator, was making his separate peace with the West. He has to go. Saddam Hussein had to go. We're going to support the Saudis in Yemen. So we've created this incredible mess in this region, you know, and then one response is that people who have some kind of religious or nationalist roots there, young people, 24, 25 years old, decide, hey, the heroic thing, I'll go and join ISIS. I'll fight against Assad. I'll fight against Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi or so forth. They go, and that's where the 9/11 people came from. They were going to fight the Russians in Chechnya, Mohammed Atta and those people, and they were called freedom fighters by Ronald Reagan. So you have this idea somehow their own political groupings are illegitimate. We can change it. We know what we're doing. And then they come back and they're monsters of your creation. And they come back and they haunt the motherland countries that have sent bombs to disturb their tranquility. That's what the reality is.
Bob, here's what it is. It's that if we're trying to figure out how do we prevent future attacks in Europe or, God forbid, in the United States, an option on the table is not go back in time and don't destabilize Syria. There are facts on the ground. Yes, a lot of those facts on the ground are a result of mistakes from U.S. foreign policy, but we have to deal with the facts of the world as they lie.
So let's take
simply
a fact.
Relitigating
I'm not 50 years of Middle East history. I'm not relitigating. The government of Belgium today, in response, instead of saying they screwed up, they didn't talk to Turkey, they didn't look at the data, they didn't do the old-fashioned work, we know what their response was? This morning, they announced they're going to go bombing in the Middle East. They're going to send planes over. They're going to take the fight there. Okay? So it's not ancient history. Intervention is the current moment. All of the candidates, as you quoted, they want to intervene even more. And instead of figuring out where does ISIS come from? Where does it get its money? Who provoked this? What is the most effective way to deal with it? You'd have to talk about Saudi Arabia. You know, you'd have to talk about the hostility towards any regime in the Middle East that does not kowtow to Saudi Arabia. That's what's the reality here. You know, you didn't have a great, and it's not ancient history. It's history that Hillary Clinton made when she was Secretary of State. Let's get real here.
We need to go to break, but let us know what you think about terrorism and counterterrorism in Europe at kcrw.com/LRC on our Facebook page or message our Twitter account. That's @LRCKCRW. Up ahead, President Obama in Cuba. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the left is Robert Scheer, editor-in-chief at TruthDig.com and host of the KCRW podcast Scheer Intelligence. On the right is Republican strategist Leslie Sanchez, and Steve Clemens of The Atlantic is also with us. So this week, President Obama visited Cuba, the first time an American president did that in nearly 90 years. Calvin Coolidge is the only other American president ever to visit Cuba, in fact. This follows new agreements on banking and scheduled air travel and other aspects of the opening of relations that have occurred over the past year and a bit. What the White House describes as taking action to cut loose the anchor of failed policies of the past and to chart a new course in U.S. relations with Cuba. Following his Cuba visit, the president traveled to Argentina, which recently elected a new president, Mauricio Macri, who's much more favorably inclined toward the U.S. than his predecessor. Leslie, has this trip been constructive for U.S.-Latin American relations, in your view?
It's going to be a mixed response overall. I think many fundamentally believe this is really just going to embolden the Castro brothers, continue to put resources in their coffers, frustrate the situation, which is really calling for more attention to the human rights violations, a demand for freedom of the press, a demand for free and open elections, and just basically an openness, not just economically, but for a democracy, for the people that live there and that are suffering. And that part of the story was not told. There were some cringeworthy moments in their conversations, and the president did address some of the human rights issues. And put some pressures there. That is a positive thing. And certainly people want to see economic growth and viability. So when you talk about even the younger Cubans who don't carry the same kind of legacy, don't have the same viewpoint of their parents and their grandparents, want to see a free and open Cuba. I think everyone fundamentally wants that. Getting there this way, though, and dealing with the Castro brothers, historically, there's a long precedence to realize it can be a failed measure, and it's something that, as much as people want to get their hopes up, it's a very difficult thing to break.
Bob, what do you see as the significance of this trip?
Oh, I think that's exactly wrong. I think these facts.
Really, Bob?
There's just no question about it. Facts, this would be like arguing that, the Cold War should continue with China, Russia, there's a reality that it's changed. And everyone in Latin America, whether they're conservative or liberal or whatever, they recognize it. And young Cubans and Cuban Americans in Florida recognize it. There's a generational break in there as well that I think has an impact on our politics. The reality is you can't have this kind of tourism and investment and changing of the internet and Google going down there with high speed and everything else. The real threat is, I think, to Castro and to the party being able to hold on to its power. This is not China with its vast population and resources and so forth. This is a small country that's going to be invaded with its great beaches and great music and great food by all sorts of people. And I think the pressure on any authoritarian regime, and it is certainly an authoritarian regime, I think it's ridiculous for the New York Times to talk about some horrible police state and everything when we have Guantanamo as the model of a horrible terrorism and torture and everything else right there in territory that we shouldn't even be occupying. But if you look at the whole, I happened to go to Cuba in the summer of 1960, just a few months before the boycott was put in place, before the Bay of Pigs. And the whole idea that Cuba was ever a national security threat to the United States was absurd until we invaded Cuba, until we did the Bay of Pigs, and then we had the missile crisis and everything else. But the idea of having made Cuba, as same as we did with Vietnam and we did with all sorts of countries, the idea of putting Cuba into that whole Cold War context was absurd from day one. What the threat with Cuba was is that Castro was a response, really, to the Catholic Church. And it's so interesting that the Pope has played this role. He was offended by the mafia control. He was offended by Batista and the corruption. And he only turned the Communist Party in Cuba opposed the Castro revolution till 6 months before he entered Havana. They were not supporters. And he only turned the way he did because the United States started the embargo very early because he had nationalized a power company and a phone company and was moving against some of the big land holdings. That was it. They didn't want a model of any kind of progressive socialism in Latin America. That's the same reason they intervened in Guatemala and everywhere else, Chile and what have you.
Steve, should we expect this opening to really change Cuba in the way Bob is suggesting? Is this going to be a huge cultural impact there? I mean, they're already open to Canada, basically.
Absolutely. I've been to Cuba a great number of times. Three times is a great number of times compared to most people. Mm-hmm. One of the great hypocrisies in our foreign policy and in this generation has been normalizing with Vietnam with the logic that engagement, commerce, dealing with each other would change the character of Vietnam. And those that have been there would argue that that has happened. John Negroponte, George W. Bush's sort of spy master, director of national intelligence, former ambassador to the UN, used to take great pride in talking about the normalization with Vietnam, which he helped engineer. And I'd always ask about Cuba, and he would begin tripping over his words because there wasn't a similar rationale for why you would try to continue a failed 55-year embargo that, if anything, continued to enhance and keep Castro's leverage over his people and the economy and the country permanently fixed. And so absolutely, there's going to be I remember talking to Cuban government officials, and I would say, you know what's going to happen. There's going to be a tsunami of commerce, a tsunami of electronic interactions, a tsunami of people-to-people contact, and you're likely to be swept away. And so what's interesting is I do think that Cuba, and now you begin to see in the magazines and newspapers that old Cuba with the old cars and the old look will fundamentally change in this kind of romantic notion of, you know, communist Cuba, where people had very few options, is something that we should be trying to preserve, which I think is ridiculous. So absolutely, Cuba will change, and the people's expectations of what they want from their lives will change, and that government will change.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Leslie Sanchez, what's your rant?
Rant is about the attack of candidate nominee wives this week when you had both Trump and Cruz's spouses in the limelight for really ridiculous statements. I don't know when it came to the point that punching to the right to the spouse became acceptable, but clearly it's not going to be okay.
Bob Scheer?
Yeah, I think the Cuba point connects with the problem of the Middle East. You know, there's blowback. And what we've discovered is that when we treat other people as if their history matters, they have competence, as Kerry is doing, by the way, much more effectively than Hillary Clinton in that Secretary of State position, we find we can have very different outcomes. And I think we start to meddle less and listen more, we'll have a much safer world.
Steve Clemens.
My rant is about racism masquerading in pugnacious nationalism in the comments of Ted Cruz about policing Muslim communities. I thought New York City Police Commissioner Bill Bratton put it right onto him and said, you know, Americans are Americans are Americans. We have Muslims serving out, you know, just after my own comments on MSNBC's Al Khalilzad, who was a Muslim a Republican ambassador to the United Nations, Iraq and Iran during the George W. Bush administration, must cringe every time people in his party take such racist, bigoted stands and sort of think that, you know, wrapping the flag around that is somehow, or that's absolutely un-American, and it frustrates me greatly.
For my rant, I want to talk about a stock, a company called Valeant Pharmaceutical. This is a company that Hillary Clinton has attacked on the campaign trail as a sort of vampire pharmaceutical company that doesn't develop drugs. It buys them and finds ways to jack up the prices. Valeant stock has gotten really beaten up over the last couple of weeks, and that's actually a really good sign about the U.S. capitalist system. Valeant has a business model based on other people making mistakes, that insurance companies won't pay close attention when they jack up the price of drugs, and that policymakers won't take appropriate steps to make sure that already existing drugs, which we don't need high prices in order to encourage their existence, don't have inappropriately high prices. People have wised up to those mistakes. The insurers and the government are starting the process of fixing those mistakes. As a result, Valeant won't make as much money as its shareholders thought, and its stock price has fallen. Not great news for Valeant shareholders, but good news for the American system of capitalism. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Robert Scheer, Leslie Sanchez, and Steve Clemens. Laura Dine Million and Hannah Tayson produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Ashleen Knutson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes, and share your comments at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.